Welcome to the Supplement Engineer Podcast. My name is Robert Chinesky. Joining us today is renowned strength coach, natural bodybuilder, registered dietitian, and the co-founder of Elemental Formulations, Mr. Ben Esgro. Ben, welcome back to the show, my friend. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. That was a very thorough introduction, too. I appreciate it.
I try to do my best, man. When somebody's got as many letters behind their name and accomplishments, I try to make sure that the audience understands just kind of the status and stature of the individuals on this podcast.
So thank you. If you put the alphabet in there, it just makes you feel and seem a lot more important. So there we go. I got to get something with Z's in there. That's the next action item for me.
There we go. So last time you were on the show, we went deep diving into several ingredients and got really nerdy with a whole bunch of science and supplement stuff. I'd like to start before, like, we'll get high level first, and then we're going to kind of drill our way down like we did last time. So last time you were on, you were running De Novo Nutrition. We've now segued into Elemental Formulation. So, and you've kind of gone into business with a rather nefarious individual, the king of the creatine cartel, Omar Issa. So, how did you get into that? How did the partnership come to be? How did y'all start this new venture together? And walk the listener through that.
So it started from iron culture. There's so many common lines with so many people, as I'm sure you've seen. I know you mentioned, like, you've been to the Arnold. I think I watched the episode with Lane, and you said that you met him there. And then I think way back before even expos and stuff, there were the bodybuilding.com forums, which were really sort of the epicenter of so much of now people who have sort of become a who's who of the powerlifting and fitness and bodybuilding community. And I was originally connected with Eric Helms, and he's actually who introduced me to multiple people within who I've either done, you know, collaborations or partnerships with. And he's the co-host with Omar on Iron Culture. So we did an episode about the supplement industry and just some of the hurdles and difficulties of running a supplement company. And it was myself, Eric, Omar, and then Mike Matthews from Legion. And pretty much as soon as we got off the call, it opened up a conversation through Helms with Omar, because he was having some difficulties as well, just frustrations, and so was I. And we just started the conversation. And it was, you know, it sounds like this is this brand new thing that we just mentioned in our launch. But I mean, this has been going on in development for like 8 months, just sort of quietly. As I was winding down De Novo, because there was a whole, as you can imagine, tons of work involved in doing that, both legally and then selling off the inventory. And basically, like, I think the quick and dirty summary of all of that is that instead of starting a new version of De Novo, this would be like another partnership change. At some point, it gets confusing, because anytime you have partners, you know, it's not just one person. So you have conversations and different directions on vision that, you know, you need to kind of unify on. And I just felt it would have been too confusing to keep doing De Novo. And it was appealing to have a fresh start, especially after COVID, because we were hit pretty hard by that too. And it just made sense to do something new. And funny enough, I had created the Elemental Formulations IG handle before Omar and I even talked. It was going to be something that I was going to do even just myself in terms of like supplement science type, I think, educational videos. And then it ended up turning into the new brand.
Yeah. Outstanding. And I would recommend for all the listeners that may not be listening to Iron Culture podcast, that's one I listen to, if not every week, then just about. I'll go back and, like, another week I'll catch up on, like, all the previous ones. I think I've listened to all 100 episodes thus far. It's a fantastic show. And, like, yeah, the episode awesome. You did with Mike and Omar and Eric was top notch, man. It's really, really good insight into the supplement industry for those that haven't listened.
Yeah, if you want to get the all of the anxiety and none of the actual real stress, you should listen to that, and you'll hear it in my voice.
So where did the name Elemental Formulations come from?
So there was actually, I'd say about two and a half years ago in doing De Novo, we had this thing called De Novo Elements. And I just love the roots of alchemy, basically like fire, earth, air, wind, water, and sort of being the precursor to chemistry, of believing like these are the things that make the world around us. Like, you know, some a food you eat is made up of certain parts air, certain parts earth, you know, that type of stuff. And I just like that. I like those roots, both from, I think, a storyline, but also the visuals of it, like the symbols that they used to have. It's just very, very neat. So we started this De Novo Elements, and it was basically, it was a lot of the people in this group that I was talking about. We were just getting on once a month, covering questions from listeners in probably too many areas, like philosophy, supplementation, programming, bodybuilding, nutrition, like everything. And that's something that I guess never left. Like it was a project I really loved, and a name I really liked. And then of course, Periodic Table of Elements. And that was really the design flow of the periodic table. I think the minimalistic aspect, the aspect that it's this simplified roadmap of almost the entire physical reality that we know of is incredible to me. So it was a major inspiration of the brand. And I know there's now a couple brands called Element or Elements and Elemental. So we wanted to be different in that, you know, okay, we're elemental, but what's really unique about us are the formulations.
Outstanding. Have y'all had any trouble sourcing ingredients? Like, I know 2020 represented numerous challenges for brands kind of across the landscape of everything. How have things been from like an ingredient sourcing, production times and all of that as we head into the first quarter of 2021?
Not good. not good. Yeah, it's been frustrating. It's supply chain across the board. It's not even ingredients. It's like jars. Sometimes it's labels. It's like shrink wrap. It's everything. Mm-hmm. So it's frustrating. And just to give you an example into our sort of inner world operationally, we actually had a great launch, and now we're projected to sell out of our original launch inventory. And I'm trying to get ahead of it. That's always what I'm trying to do. And usually turn times were like 6 to 8 weeks. Sometimes you could find a manufacturer that would turn faster than that. And now they've all doubled. So like we put agreements in place of turn times, just because, again, this will give you almost an insider look into some of the stuff that you have to deal with when you work with a private manufacturer. If you're not like, let's say CVS, and you're running a million bottles of, you know, calcium carbonate or something, just, you know, something that's generic, but you're doing massive volume, then obviously you're going to fall somewhere back in the queue, because they're going to deal with the customer that brings them the most money. They're a business. And I sort of lost my train of thought. I apologize. I forget where I was trying to go with that. But basically the negotiability, this is where I was going. So if you don't have some type of pre-agreement in place that the turn time is going to absolutely be 6 to 8 weeks, then you'll just keep getting pushed back, because they have, the manufacturer's not losing. They've already collected at least half of your money. So you need to have some type of agreement in place that you mutually agree to this date. And if not, both parties lose, not just us, the supplement company.
Right.
So we had an agreement in place prior with De Novo, and it was a 6 to 8 week turn time, and our manufacturer wouldn't even agree to something like that. The closest they'd agree was 12. And that's just based on same stuff. And this is another important part, is it's not just the turn times that have changed. It's also the raw materials that have gone up. So our price, just to run Utopia, has increased like $3.
Damn.
Yep.
Like, for the listeners out there, that may not seem a lot, but like $3 on the production cost, you basically double that if you're going to distribution, and then double that again if you're going to go into retail. So if you make a product that's $9, it's going to end up being what, $18, $36 on the shelf at a minimum.
And you have to consider that these are not cheap formulas to make from the start. So you're talking a $3 addition on top of it. It hurts. It makes it hard, because, you know, unless you're selling, I don't know, flour in a bottle and calling it creatine, you're not making these incredible margins. If you're using really good ingredients and you're dosing them right, even if you're doing blends of things to kind of knock down the amounts of some of the most expensive things, it gets expensive. And mm-hmm. This industry, it's getting more and more saturated and more competitive. And a lot of people are marketing on being scientific. So even if they're using, let's say, a fourth of the ideal dose, it's still expensive. And the first thing that comes to mind for me is like CDP choline or Cognizin, to use the licensed version of it. That's an insanely expensive ingredient, even if you're using it at, you know, 150 milligrams. Like, there's just no way around it. It's expensive.
Right. Yeah, and that's what you brought up. That I'm working on working with a brand right now on some nootropic formulas, and I keep pushing for Cognizant or even just the generic CDP choline, because I like that form that much better than Alpha GPC.
Yeah.
And the cost difference between those two, I mean, it's like night and day, and you wouldn't think that, but. I mean, this isn't even talking about like the alpha size form of alpha GPC. It's the generic just as well. And for some reason, CDP choline costs exceptionally more than alpha GPC does. And I'm not really sure why. Do you have any insight into that? Why it might be?
So I know for Kiawa is who owns the patent on Cognizin. Mm-hmm. And that usually drives price up. Obviously, just like we've seen with Carnosine, the beta alanine version. If you go with that, it's more expensive. Just that name you're sort of paying for. I got to imagine that there's something in the synthesis of it that drives it up. I don't know exactly what that is. But just from our experience, we've actually dealt with all three. I never used Alpha GPC prior. We do use it now in our Prime Pre.
Right.
And we use the CDP choline in Utopia. We actually originally used the Cognizin in Utopia. And the reason we actually moved away from it was, the only thing that would kind of fall to the bottom once you try to mix it in the solution would be the Cognizin. It would kind of gel and fall to the bottom, and it would be hard getting it into solution. And that was a pretty common thing. Honestly, I don't think anybody didn't buy the product because of that, but I'm neurotic. I always want stuff to be perfect. So I wanted to find an alternative to that. Obviously, it was a benefit that CDP, the sodium salt, is not as expensive because you're not paying for the patent. But really, the major reason we made the change was because it's a salt. So whenever you make a salt of any ingredient, you actually increase the polarity, which means you put it in a polar substance like water, it's going to break apart easier. Same thing with the creatine hydrochloride or any creatine salt. So that's why we went with it. Like you mentioned about the Alpha GPC, that's a really interesting ingredient. It'd be awesome to be able to use in a powder the full 100% or 99% alpha GPC, but that thing gels like a son of a bitch. Like, it turns everything into gel. So the alpha size, which is 50%, is usually better. I think they use Malto or something, to kind of reduce the gelling. But yeah, if I'm to be honest, I do like the CDP better, just from a formulation aspect on many levels. I think alpha GPC is effective mechanistically, and you feel it as well. Like, it's a solid cholinergic, but I think having worked with both, I prefer CDP myself.
Yeah. With the manufacturer, are y'all using, and you don't have to discuss or divulge who the exact manufacturer is, but are y'all using the same one from DeNova, or did you kind of go and vet other manufacturers with the start of Elemental?
We are constantly vetting. We're using the same one, I'm always looking. I'm of the belief that it's good to have a backup to your backup, just because of what happens. So we had a rotation a little bit in DeNova if we needed a really fast turn time. But of course, when you have different vendors, you're talking about potential quality control issues. So we did have some inconsistencies that I didn't like prior, and not every manufacturer is going to agree to the terms that you have with the one that you work with the most. So that was an issue that we had as well. So we are working with the same one that we use for DeNova, but we're always looking, of course, because this is an ever-changing landscape. Mm-hmm. And I think capabilities are a thing. So maybe one of the vendors or one of the manufacturers can do, let's say, stick packs. The other one can't. One can do compressed tabs. The other one can only do like capsules, like all that type of stuff. It makes you have to sort of stay on your feet. The short answer to your question is that we're using the same one, but like I said, we're always looking.
Okay, perfect. With that, the changing landscape, the FDA is starting to up its game a little bit more. More ingredients are starting to not necessarily get banned, but they're going on this advisory list. Mm-hmm. They're also starting to crack down more on claims that companies are making. And I'm starting to notice a trend, especially with some of the brands, like they're not even listing what ingredients do anymore on their site. It's like, hey, pre-workout, this is what it is. We're not going to say supports dopamine production, enhances athletic performance. How do y'all approach that from, you know, this is something I struggle with too, because if I have a study in front of me that says, hey, L-citrulline can lower blood pressure by, you know, 3 or 4 points, why in the world can I not put on the website says shown in research to help reduce blood pressure, or, you know, instead of just putting supports cardiovascular health? So give the listeners a little bit of an insight into how we have to toe the line regarding structure and function claims and when you're formulating and selling the supplements.
Yeah, so a lot of this stuff comes down to legal definitions and legal stuff. And I think, again, I'll try to give the short answer first and then maybe tangent into my long version. But I think it's largely to protect or keep some level of separation between what is a drug and what is a supplement, because that line does dramatically gray. I think on multiple levels. I think it grays in terms of efficacy. I think some supplement ingredients really, like you're mentioning, have efficacy that mirrors a drug. I think a great example is like the statin that's in red yeast rice is a statin. I mean, it's a drug. And again, these definitions, it can go down the rabbit hole really quickly. That's why a lot of gray area stuff can end up in supplements and, you know, stuff that's happened of the past. It's why it can happen, because you know, nature can produce things that are very potent mechanistically. And then a drug company realizes this, they want to either make a lead compound out of it to make a future more potent version of it, or the version itself has activity like a drug that's very high potency. And then as soon as you isolate it, technically it becomes a drug. And if it's a component of a food, if it's a metabolite, if it's an amino acid, those are all supposed to qualify as a supplement. But this all kind of goes back to a 1994 DSHEA. So it's the Drug and Supplement Health Education Act, something like that. And this defined basically what is a drug and supplement. We're still using those definitions of that. And then basically anything before then is supposed to have been grandfathered in. Anything that's new that isn't covered or wasn't grandfathered in. That's why like DHEA, technically now, if it was just introduced, it probably wouldn't be able to be sold as a supplement. Whereas since it was in before then, it's grandfathered in. But if you try to bring anything new to the market, and I don't know if this is where you're going with it or not, so we can totally stop my tangent after this, but
no, it's perfect.
You have to file an NDI, which basically means a new dietary ingredient. And that can be sort of a slippery slope. That's something that I'm actually in the process of doing. And maybe soon I'll have an update on how difficult that actually is. I do think it depends on how good supporting data and evidence you have. But to come back to the root of the question, you're totally right. It's frustrating. It's a slippery slope, but it's largely because you can't claim to be a drug or have drug activity if you're a supplement.
Gotcha.
So, and I think it's a money thing.
Yeah, it's possible too. You mentioned NDI, so I take it you're working on maybe as some kind of new extract or compound you've unveiled, and you're going to be one of the first to introduce it to the industry.
Fingers crossed. I hope. I'm going to be careful because I know people listen to this, and I'd love to be able to talk freely about it, but we just don't live in that kind of world.
No, we'll do that after the record button's been clicked off.
We'll get on
the after hours special.
But what I will say is it's a metabolite, and it's something that you naturally make from ingesting something that's already a common supplement ingredient, but it has actually better properties than the parent compound. So there could be a lot of avenues to work down with it. So I'm hoping. It's very hard to source, and I've looked into making it myself at scale. And it's not something I want to do just because, let's just say this, your body is way more efficient at metabolizing certain things than it is to do it in a lab. Like the harshness of some of the reagents in the reaction. Yeah, I wish I had an external liver where I could just feed it in, pump it out, and then just.
When you're sourcing ingredients or maybe exploring new ingredients to bring to the market or include in your formulas, how do you approach that? I'm always curious. Like when people are bringing, like we'll see certain companies will bring like an extract that nobody else you really see and or very few companies are using. So what's going through your mind as a formulator, an ingredient research nut, when you're trying to figure out these, are you going through pathways? Are you thinking like, hey, I see a compound in that food. Maybe it's in this food as well. You know, how walk us through the mental machinations that go on.
I mean, I consider it. It's sort of no holds barred. I mean, I look everywhere in terms of potential leads. There's a phenomenal show. I actually was going to post about it last night that I love. That it's not supplement ingredients, but it's pharmacology, and it's more so like street drugs he covers. It's on Vice. It's called Hamilton's Pharmacology or Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. It's amazing. It goes into the chemistry of stuff. It goes into the whole social history of stuff. It goes into the pharmacology of stuff. So I'm definitely leaning now more heavily on pharmacology, but plant pharmacology. So I'll buy textbooks on alkaloids. I just recently bought a new one. I'll buy textbooks on natural medicinal products. That was some of my coursework in the degree I just finished. And I loved that part way more than I loved actually like the, you know, talking about the classes of drugs. I think natural plant chemistry is amazing. It's humbling. It's amazing on so many levels. So I'm looking there. I'm looking in approved drugs and those mechanisms and the ones that are actually either the blockbuster drugs or the things that work really well. And then seeing if I can find a related compound that's similar, that's made in the plant. I'm looking in studies, trying to find something that's most recently published. If I'm really trying to go from a lead and make up a lot of area in this gap where I'm just not finding anything in any of those first places, I'll look at supplements that are on the market already that work, that are very popular. This is usually more so in the stimulant area. And I'll look at either targets, or you can actually predict the receptor that certain ligands will interact with. There's actually computer technology to use for that. There's some great websites. Chemicalize is actually a great one that you can predict physical chemical properties. So I'm looking at that as well in terms of, okay, you know, will this dissolve? What's the predicted solubility if there's no data available for that? So it's really all of these things, but I think the most important part, you know, we can make this sound a lot more highbrow than it is. At some point you need to experiment. And a lot of it is experimentation and looking at combinations. So I think one of the things that is most intriguing to me, like that whole first section of things that I talked about, that path that I go down, I think that's a lot of just mental excitement. You could call it mental masturbation. I don't know. But I think the practical aspect of where it always comes back to is what's available now in supplements. What can I use in ways that people either I consider misuse or they haven't considered using it in this way? And there's a lot of ingredients. Like I'll give some insight into one thing that I've been playing with, and I don't think it's probably going to manifest in anything, but I was looking at trying to extend the half-life of caffeine. And there's so many ingredients that work with the liver enzyme that actually breaks it down. And again, I'm trying to sort of select the right path to go down with this. What's interesting with that, though, is the amount, number one, the amount of research where they've done into, you know, if you change this one route of caffeine metabolism, what happens? Like, let's say you block the CYP 1A2. I couldn't remember what the name of it is. That's the primary, actually, liver enzyme that breaks down caffeine. And so if you block that, you actually account for it by another enzyme in the pathway. Like one of them is xanthine oxidase. So one of my thoughts was like, okay, well, what if we block all three. And there's actually, again, a lot of these plant compounds will have activity either inducing or reducing the activity of those pathways. Like one of them is St. John's wort. It's a different family of CYP of liver enzymes that it inhibits. But plant compounds particularly are notoriously, they have a lot of interactions. That's why, you know, combining medications with supplements can be a very dangerous game to play, and why we put that on the label for everything. But anyway, again, I did a terrible job of answering that short. There's always so much to talk about. I think it's a combination of research, of theory, and experimentation, which probably would have been the best way to start the answer. But the experimentation part is always so huge, because the end point you're always reaching for is, can you feel that effect? Like, if I can, you know, put up 20 studies and support it and say all these nice things, I'm not even interested in that. Like, it's gotta be fun. You have to feel the difference. And I started this as a supplement consumer, not a businessman of just like, how can we maximize profit? Mm-hmm. And like I said, pour a bunch of flour in and call it creatine. I'm not interested in that.
Yeah. Along those lines, since plants have so many fun other little like bioactives, aside from like the main one that we're always trying to drive at or get the thrust of effects from, what are your thoughts on caffeine anhydrous versus something like a coffee extract or like a natural green coffee extract or a green tea extract that is standardized to caffeine, but it has all those fun actives in it? Just from like it could be your end of one experience with how like the energy hits. Does it hit harder? Does it hit softer? But does it maybe last longer? Is it smoother? Because we see more of these natural extracts or caffeine sources coming into supplements. What are your thoughts on them?
I think there's a lot of fluff in the industry that obviously borrows from the food industry. And we know that, you know, there's this big push for organic, for natural. You just use the natural buzzword, you're going to get a whole crowd attracted to your product that probably wasn't before. And even if that's total bullshit, you know, like you're still using a chemical to extract the caffeine. It's just like, we've just deemed these certain categories of chemicals, oh, okay, that's natural, that's fine. And these ones are not. When, you know, you could find dichloromethane in nature, you can find all these, you know, exotic, more dangerous chemicals. The reason I specifically use dichloromethane is that's actually the best route of extracting caffeine. You can do it through water, but the more natural sort of benign way that they're doing now, that I'm sure a lot of these extracts are doing, is supercritical CO2, which is actually great as a solvent. Again, that's another rabbit hole that I'm just not going to go down unless you want to. That's a very cool extraction method. Anyway, to answer your other question, it's difficult because there's always so many avenues to go down in the answer. I think my first answer always, from a formulation perspective, is potency. Dose is the best thing that we can control. It's, in my opinion, the most important part, because we know that you need a certain, there's a threshold of, you know, the window of the therapeutic window, which is the pharmacological definition of where you actually have activity. And then before it, you don't have anything. If you don't hit the threshold, and after it, you start seeing signs of toxicity. Every compound has a different therapeutic window. So I like to always defer to caffeine anhydrous because it's the most potent. I could put in 200 and it's 200. It's not hydrated caffeine. It's 200 of caffeine. And when you go with these other versions, yeah, do you get other things? Yeah. Might there be maybe an entourage effect of some of the other things that work alongside caffeine, you know, in a food or plant matrix? Yeah. But in terms of stimulation, no. There are some things I like that argument for, like some herbals that are standardized. I like that for, not caffeine though, because most people want the kick and the stimulation from caffeine. And even if you're doing like the dicaffeine malate or the salts of it, again, you have to realize that that's taking up some bulk. Like, okay, you know, the malic acid moiety of the compound is a certain molecular weight. So let's say it's 20%. Okay, well, you're getting 20% less caffeine. So that's all sort of a consideration in it. Are there maybe some avenues? I'll back up a little bit and I'll say, if I'm trying to get inactive and use the function of that other active by using one active that's a more full spectrum extract, I'd much rather use the two isolated purified versions. So let's say there's the chlorogenic acid I want from a green coffee bean extract, which does have good health properties. I'd rather just use that and dose control that, because standardization is a huge, huge issue that's difficult, even when you're using an isolated, you know, amino acid or something, where, you know, that ability to control that dose is hard. And to make sure it's in the end product at the amount you want is also very hard. That's a QC issue. And that's a whole other can of worms when you're talking about sedimentation in a powder and all that stuff. So I like the control that having a purified ingredient allows you as a formulator, because then you can control solubility better and all those things. So I went around the world there as quick as I could.
No, man, that was perfect. That's exactly what I was looking for. And I was doing a podcast, it was 2 weeks ago, and I said something. I don't think I spoke again for like 15 or 20 minutes. And the guest was saying, I'm sorry, I was rambling. I thought that's the entire part. Anytime I can just ask something and sit back and not do anything for like 10 or 15 minutes, that's why I have this podcast. It's like, get really awesome dialogue and discussion. If like you wanted to lecture for the remainder of the time that we're on, yeah, that's, I'm just here to give you guys a platform to share your wisdom and knowledge and experience. So I love it. You feel free to ramble and rant as much as you want to.
I appreciate you giving me the green light on that. I do my best to try to pull it back in, but yeah, if I get passionate about something, it just happens.
Absolutely, man. No, it's a good thing. It's great. Let's dive into the pre-workout, prime pre-workout. So I'll give the listeners a rundown of the ingredients real quick, and then we can kind of jump into why you went certain ways with certain ingredients. We got 8 grams of citrulline malate, 3.2 grams of beta alanine, 2 grams of sodium citrate, 2 grams of potassium citrate, 2 grams of N-acetyl L-tyrosine, 500 milligrams of Vasodrive AP, which is definitely not cheap, 300 milligrams of caffeine anhydrous, 300 milligrams of alpha GPC 50%, and 200 micrograms of huperzine. So, yeah, I mean, most of the time we see like 128, 254 of Vasodrive AP. You and I can only think maybe two or three other companies that are using like the 500, like that really hefty dose where you're going to start noticing like significant benefits. So walk us into that, because I don't believe that was in the De Novo pre-workout, if memory serves me right.
So we did have Vasodrive in what was Ignite then. Basically what changed from De Novo Ignite to Prime Pre for Elemental is the stimulant, pretty much the entire stimulant formulation changed. The only thing we really kept was the same amount of caffeine. So we removed the Ohimbine. Again, that's sort of a rabbit hole, but I think the quick answer to that one is Ohimbine's an interesting ingredient. It's sort of like a Jekyll and Hyde. I know we talked about last time my way of trying to avoid people having too stressful or anxious of an experience from Ohimbine by adding in theanine. I kind of wanted to just get out of that whole rabbit hole and issue. I don't love theanine. If I include it, it's usually going to be with a stronger stimulant like that, or at a lower dose. But I think you can actually, let's say, level out the stimulant, the stimulation and the experience without needing to use theanine. And I do think it pulls back a little bit of the joy of caffeine stimulation. So I'd much prefer to use other ways that actually enhance the stimulation, but also level out caffeine. And that's the wonderful thing of Utopia is, those other supporting ingredients in Utopia, like cholinergics. So the huperzine, the choline source. So in Utopia, it's CDP choline. In Prime Pre, it's the alpha GPC. I just wanted to level it out and I think take from something that worked so well in the Utopia formula and actually make a more full pre-workout version of a kind of built out Utopia formula. So taking the core stuff of Ignite, which was the hydration salts, so the citrate, but also citrate as a buffer. It's tough to put it in there at the full dose, but I'd like to think that there's, even if there's a, you know, somewhat of an effect, it's something. Better than zero. So at the very least, you're getting hydration, but you're getting citrate as well. Citrate gets converted to bicarb, bicarb's a buffer. And combining that in with beta-alanine, at the very least, theoretically, you should improve any buffering capacity that beta-alanine has, because you're working on two different cell components, whereas beta-alanine is an intracellular buffer via carnosine, and then citrate salts are actually extracellular buffers. So that's the idea of that component. VasoDrive, I just love it. I actually found it through one of my courses. We were actually doing, we were focused on angiotensin converting enzyme, and it was actually peanut peptides. There was a paper that was published on peanut peptides that inhibit ACE. So I couldn't find anything that was licensed that was on the market. This must have just been a lab that was theoretically looking at these peptides. So I thought, oh, this has to be available somewhere. Some company has to have seen this and exploited this. And that's how I stumbled upon VasoDrive, because VasoDrive is hydrolyzed casein that's, what's the word I'm looking for? It's made more potent with VPP and IPP, which are the two peptides in question. And I was really interested. And then I actually saw some of the human data. And I was like, okay, this has a mechanism. This actually has been used in humans. This is really fascinating. Problem is bioavailability is very low. Just like we know, you can't take insulin orally. A lot of it gets cleaved and broken down individual amino acids. The same problem is going to persist with these peptides, but they've actually shown that, you know, there's a small percentage that actually does make it into the blood. So I think, you know, if you're at 250, I would even question whether it's worth putting in there. So if we're going to put it in, we got to put it in at the full amount. Again, I like the idea of synergy, attacking something from multiple pathways. That's what our stimulation complex does. Why we're hitting stuff at, you know, let's not just go 500 milligrams of caffeine. Let's, you know, hit it from, you know, acetylcholine perspective. Let's, you know, hit it from dopamine, potentially serotonin, you know, like what other things we have to work with. So that was the philosophy of approaching the blood flow component as well of this. So you have the citrulline, which is a direct precursor to nitric oxide, and then going with the angiotensin converting approach as well, pathway with the VasoDrive. Let me see, did I miss anything else to touch on with Prime Pre? You tell me, is there anything else that was intriguing of that? Oh, the tyrosine.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. I typically defer to the L-tyrosine, not the acetyl. Like, I know the acetyl has better solubility, but
yep.
There was some data showing that I had come across that regular tyrosine was more efficiently converted in the body. But I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Maybe there's some newer research that I'm not aware of or something.
So it's most likely the same research. And I was digging in. I've looked at, if you've seen some of the other studies, there's actually other either salts or peptides of tyrosine that mm-hmm. are superior to straight tyrosine in terms of high solubility and also high conversion. One of them is, I can't remember. It's like, I think L-alanyl, L-tyrosine or something. But those peptides, you can find suppliers who will make them, but they're astronomically expensive. Like, you'd have to have a product that was, you know, just 5 grams in a bottle, and that's it. Like, there's nothing else, and that's just not exciting to do. There's also another one. I think it's phosphorus bound somewhere instead of at the nitrogen. So it's something phosphotyrosine. I looked into that. I actually got it from a chemical supplier to play with myself, and I looked at trying to scale it up again, either myself or through, you know, these chemical companies who will do custom synthesis for you. And it's cost prohibitive. So I couldn't go down that. I was frustrated. This has been a problem that I've been sort of banging my head over for a long time. I don't like straight tyrosine simply because it basically makes a suspension. It looks like milk. I don't like that. I like making pre's clear. I think people notice that. I like solubility to be as high as possible. I hate when stuff falls to the bottom. That's one of my biggest gripes with, you know, adding creatine in a pre is the first thing to fall to the bottom is going to be the least soluble ingredient. That usually tends to be creatine. Right. And it's one of the best ones. You don't want that falling to the bottom of your shaker bottle. So I wanted something that was high solubility and actually went and dug back through the studies to see if there was something I was missing. And I knew that N-acetylcysteine is an accepted ingredient. And there's got to be something that I'm missing in this. And I actually went through the pharmacokinetics of N-acetylcysteine to see, is there something I'm missing? Why would N-acetyltyrosine not be getting converted, but N-acetylcysteine is? Mm-hmm. And I found that every study that shows there's a shortcoming to N-acetyltyrosine is actually an infusion. It's not given orally. So people would say, well, why is that a difference? So you actually have deacetylases in your intestines. You don't have them in your blood vessels. So if you infuse it, you're going to dramatically limit your ability to convert it to tyrosine, and it's going to have to get excreted out. Maybe your liver, I think, or your kidneys have a little bit, a smaller amount of deacetylase. So you do get like a 20% conversion when you have an infusion. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's 100%. So I'm not claiming that it's as efficacious as straight tyrosine. But what I am saying is I don't buy the, I think that first place where people go to immediately argue it and saying, well, it doesn't get converted. Yeah, in an infusion, but we're not infusing people. It's no longer a supplement then if we're doing that.
Right.
So I think there's a few things. Number one, that's why we went with a much higher dose, even if the conversion is anywhere less than quantitative, so anywhere below 100, which I'm assuming it is. And then number two, the high solubility, I like that, and I actually like the flavor that it imparts. It gives almost a tanginess. Mm-hmm. That's different, again, because it's acetic acid is vinegar, so it gives that sort of tanginess taste to it. So it's another dimension of flavor. And even at 20%, we're really only putting it, like, let's just say it's only as effective as the infusion studies say it is. So only roughly 20% does get converted to tyrosine. It's only in there as a support ingredient. It's not really a primary, but I think it's definitely better. I don't have the studies, you know, or the data to back up saying it's above 20, but just based on the theory, knowing that we have acetylases, then in the gut, it's got to be better than 20. If I had the money to fund the study, I would. I don't right now.
No, that's a great argument too, because yeah, like you mentioned, NAC is effectively converted in the body. So is acetyl L-carnitine, which has also got that acetyl yep. group on there too. So. Yeah, that's a really, really good argument, and something I hadn't actually considered when always debating NALT versus tyrosine. That's fascinating.
This came out of frustration and out of really, like I said, getting sick of banging my head against the wall with not finding viable alternatives. Mm-hmm. And like I said, if it gets to a point for me and I'm frustrated enough, I'll say it. I'm going to make it myself. Like, fuck it. I'm going to get a lab. I'm going to scale it up. But I don't want to do that because, you know, personally, I'd love to do that. But when you're talking about, you know, efficiency of time, it becomes, you know, that's a very, very arduous process. And then getting it right, making sure there's, you know, less than 0.005% impurities in it. Like, you're asking... I'm not an organic chemist by profession. So I can do this stuff for fun on the side, but it's a whole different, you know, occupation that I'm only really going to do if I'm totally backed into a corner. So I dug back through it and that's what I found. So who knows, maybe in a couple months or years, we'll find somebody who actually does that study. But as for now, I stick to my theoretical basis for including it. And I will say this too. Sorry. One more point.
No.
There's an experiential component to it as well. And yes, I'm sort of a purist in that I always like to use my own products, but that doesn't mean I don't use other ones. And I think that's bad if you're not benchmarking against competitors either. And one of the things that I found this repeatedly and I couldn't explain it. And I was really, really frustrated because I was like, okay, the data says this, but this is what's happening in my experience. What the hell is going on here? And I was buying C4, I think it was, the RTD, mm-hmm. and they put N-acetyltyrosine in, and a lot of brands put it in pre still, and they put it in really low dose.
Yeah.
And whenever I used the C4 RTD, I felt a different stimulation that was above that that I felt from caffeine. And all the ingredients are on there. So I knew the only thing that actually had a plausible mechanism to be causing that was the tyrosine. So I just bought bulk tyrosine and I just started doing sort of dose response with myself. And I know that the data says that straight tyrosine, if you want stimulation, you need like 10 to 12 grams. It's really, really high. And those are like military studies that they did. So I knew it'd have to be a high dose. And that was the other thing for me is like, I'm going to have to use the salt if I want to get a dose anything higher. So we're actually in order of magnitude above the dose that they use in C4, the RTD. I think they're like 200 milligrams. I wanted to make sure we got something from it, but still rely on the stimulants for the main kick.
Yeah, well put. And then the other thing, I can't imagine how much of a flavor challenge this was. You've got 2 grams of sodium citrate, 2 grams of potassium citrate, so you're getting 460 milligrams of sodium and 800 milligrams of potassium. Most companies have like 100 to 150, maybe 200 milligrams of sodium in their pre-workout. So is that, how does this thing taste is what I'm curious about. How much of a challenge was that?
I will say this, the base pre is sour. It's definitely sour. And so is the prime. They're still pretty sour, but the advantage of the citrates, is that you can buffer some of that acidity as well. So I actually, so I'll do that even before just in beta testing, you know, I'll use pH strips or I actually have a meter. So I'll make sure where it is. So our flavoring component itself is like a pH 2 or 3, and actually the finalized formula with that amount of citrulline malate. So that's like 4 grams of malic acid plus the acetyl tyrosine. We're actually at a pH 4. And I think that's largely because we went up, you know, like logarithmic, we went up pH. So I think that actually helped. The other nice part about sodium citrate in particular is it is a flavor enhancer because you get some of the salinity of sodium, which can improve taste. It's, you have to do masking in a lot of these things too. That certainly helps, but people love the prime pre taste. We haven't had as much feedback on the base pre, but it tastes just like a sweet tart. Like that's exactly, if you've ever had a red sweet tart, base pre tastes exactly like that. I'm never going to claim it's not tart or sour. It definitely is. But I think we've done a great job in masking it. And it just comes down to some of the nitty gritty stuff. And I think the fun of formulation.
Outstanding. Before, when we were setting up this podcast, you said you were listening to mine with Lane and you wanted to touch on something that we had, analytics and some of the common industry misconceptions. So let's dive into that with our remaining time and I'll let you kind of have the floor and we can kind of jump off from there.
Sure. So this is a really common thing that we saw in deciding what we're going to do with testing, and one of our main points in not just doing third-party testing, but publishing our results is, I think basically what Lane talked about a little bit was, you know, where you come out in potency in your post-testing, in your finished product testing. And there actually are FDA guidelines for that, believe it or not. Now, are they going to come and chase you and enforce those things? Most likely not. But where you're going to get yourself into trouble is if you are picked off the shelf and tested by a lab door, a consumer lab, any of these, you know, these entities now that have sort of exploded onto the industry landscape. So what they're going to test is according to those FDA guidelines. And basically those guidelines say that any purified ingredient needs to be there at 100% or more. So you actually can test out above 100, but you can't test out below. And if it's an herbal, it can test out 80, but not below. So one of the things that you'll see on our label is when we put our standardized ingredient, we actually put not less than, because that's the legal way it's supposed to be put on the label. But the other thing is we set our own criteria and benchmark criteria to make sure we're hitting potency. And it is true that it's very, very difficult to do in a more complex formula. So like prime pre is more difficult because again, this gets into the physics of the of mixing, but basically what happens is every ingredient has different bulk density. Some things are going to float, you know, to the bottom, to the top. Technically, these mixers and mixer technology is supposed to address it. It still sort of happens, so you can get sedimentation. Just like when you look at rock, you have one layer that's sort of below the other. Sometimes that happens in ingredients, and you can have some issues in testing out post with potency. But we actually, so we had that in our run, and you have to confirm it in your post analysis. So you retest, make sure, you know, was there something wrong with the analysis or was it off? And then in the retest, we tested out correct. But, yeah, basically the FDA states that you have to test that at 100%. You can have overage, and this is an industry, this is a common, actually essential industry thing for any manufacturer, is they'll put in intentional ingredient overages. There's actually a whole, if someone Googles that term, you can read a lot more about it. But what's interesting is FDA does not set a limit. So you can actually test out like way above, and you are technically legal by FDA standard, but you don't really want to do that, number one, for a cost reason. Second, the way I look at it is you don't want to test out anywhere above what the normal dosage range of something is. Right. But anyway, so where did this all sort of come from with me? I was actually looking at Labdoor, and when you read some of their post-tests, a lot of their stuff that they green check mark, you either can't find the quantitation, you can't find the amount that it's in there. And then when you can, I've read a couple of them and they're testing out low and they're passing it. And I'm like, what is this? So the only place I know that doesn't do that is Consumer Lab, because you can actually read what their criteria is. And it mirrors that FDA guideline. And if anybody wants to dig in and read that or find that, it's in the CFR. So you can Google like FDA dietary supplement CFR. You can also read what the USP guidelines are for testing, which I consider the absolute gold standard. And they mirror the same thing. They actually cite the FDA standard. So to sort of rewind a little bit and go back to, I think, some of the end important points are really you should have a 5% buffer. And that's just standard error. There's something in any analyticals called in any analytical testing called uncertainty of measurement. And that's why if you buy a thermometer, if you buy a calibrated beaker, anything calibrated, a calibrated scale, it's going to say plus minus 5%, which is usually that's their uncertainty of measurement. So I think you should be given that. That's actually our benchmark as well. So we try to stay within plus minus 5%. But beyond that, you are actually technically testing out low if you're below that amount. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do. It's very difficult, but we've had conversations with our manufacturer. And again, like that's a major point for us. And that's why we don't even trust our manufacturer's word. We go and we do the third party, testing on top of it to make sure, because I want to be putting into my body, you know, 100% as well of what I think it is, not just the customers. Right. And last point is, this is something that's across the board. I think we're seeing now this sort of this merging of more and more as more years go on of dietary supplements being looked at or scrutinized like pharmaceuticals are. And I think that's one step in the right direction in the next evolution of things. And they're doing this with CBD. They're doing it with THC. They're doing it with, you know, these other things that are gray area, pseudo pharmaceuticals. And I actually, a lot of companies do it with SARMs. So I just thought like, we're supplements. We're not gray area. We should, you know, some things maybe are, but we should be adhering to that same level of quality control and showing it and publishing it. And it came down to the choice of like, do we do, you know, this bans for sport certification, or do we do the third party potency? And like, I've toured the manufacturer. We have all the things in place, knowing that why would they be putting that in, you know, if we're not telling them? It makes no sense from a financial perspective. They don't even carry any banned substances in their facility. So I don't know how it would even get in there. So I'd much rather spend that money on doing the potency one, making sure that it's testing out at what we say, and that if someone does test us from one of these agencies, that we're not going to get knocked, and that we know it, and we have our own feet to defend ourselves on legally, because we've done it from a third party.
Very well put. And I will say a few remarks for listeners. That third party testing, I wish it was almost a requirement that all brands did it. It adds considerable expense to the final product that you're paying. But I've heard from multiple brand owners that they don't care about the additional expense. It allows them to sleep better at night. You know, if you can find companies that are willing to do third-party testing, that's an added measure of protection for you, the consumer, that you're not going to get something spiked or anything like that.
I would bet money that, and this is one of the things that Lane said that I would totally agree with. I would bet money that 90% of the products on the shelves don't test out, especially if you're talking about something like a 20 ingredient formula. I would bet money that is not testing out at the amounts that they're stating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Peter Cohen, you mentioned different testing agency. Peter Cohen over at Harvard has tested a bunch of different stimulants, stuff like DMHA, hygienamine, and like he's found stuff that is 80% over what it should be, or like 5% of what's listed on the label. I mean, it really is a minefield.
It is.
With dietary supplements, especially with prop blends. Finally, Ben, the Prime Whey, watermelon sorbet. That is the lone flavor y'all have of the protein supplement. I have not seen a watermelon sorbet protein flavor yet. How did y'all come up with this flavor? Was this widely requested? You know, because typically we see vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, cookies and cream, peanut butter, stuff like that. So let's dive into that real quick.
I think the first path that we wanted to go down was we're very anti-BCAAs, and a lot of I don't hate BCAAs just for existing. I just hate the marketing of them. Like, I have nothing against the molecules. There's nothing wrong with them. But the way that they're pushed and the way that they're still sold without the evidence to back it up is very frustrating. I have a problem with that, especially when you have a complete protein available. So the only support that I ever saw that people say, and fine, if they can justify spending $50, $60 to have great tasting flavored water, okay. But if that's your only defense standing, then let's make a protein that's complete. Okay.
Are you close?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. There's my mom for everybody who's a listener.
Right. Okay. We'll be done in 1 minute.
Let me just finish my thought. Okay. So actually everybody should know her, because the original De Novo started here in my parents' house, and she supported this from day one. So I'm happy everybody gets to see Joan. If that's really the only justification people have, then why not make a complete protein that tastes good in water, that tastes just as good, if not better, than BCAAs, and has, you know, similar mixability. So that was the initial thought. And then the second one was, there's other companies that are starting to do this, and we benchmarked all of them, and some were good, but all of them had some type of asterisk, like some type of deficiency, like it's good, but it leaves this, you know, weird film on your tongue, or it's good, but man, it, like, the protein quality is good, but the taste is horrendous. So I just wanted to try to limit any of those, you know, asterisk conditions, and try to eradicate BCAAs and give people, you know, no more justification to be spending that money just to be getting good flavored water. Like, now you can get a full spectrum of amino acids, and actually the protein we use, it's equivalently high in branch chains. It's 2-to-1-to-1 ratio, which is the ratio that's actually naturally occurring. But we're actually almost at 3 grams of leucine per scoop in a 20 gram protein serving. So it's very potent in leucine too.
Outstanding. Ben, I know you need to get going, sir. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now's the part where you can shamelessly plug anything and everything about coaching services, Elemental Formulations, and whatever else you got, man.
I think I'll just leave it to Elemental Formulations. Elemental.fit is the website. Check us out. If you ever have any questions, either me or Omar, I try to answer any kind of question people have on any of the technical, scientific formulation, any of that stuff. So definitely reach out. If you have feedback, if you have questions, you can email us too through Elemental. But last, thank you, Robert, because like I said in the messages, I love what you're doing. I support it. I'm happy that you have me on, but I actually love listening too. And I think it's awesome that you have this platform here for people to learn more about supplements. So we are very much on the same wavelength of what we want to do with the industry. So thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you for your time, Ben. And thank you for the kind words too, man. It will not be as long before we have you back on the show. I love our conversations, and we could talk for hours, my friend. So thank you very much, and have a great week.
Thank you. You too.